Morning, everyone. How was breakfast? Sorry about the smoke in here. Is this okay? Can you manage? We have the windows open, so hopefully it'll air itself out. I really wanted to stay in here because it's really big and spacious and colorful. So I didn't want to go downstairs into the common room. For how many people is it their first retreat, residential retreat? Okay. And for how many people is their first time sitting, meditating, coming to a meditation retreat? So how's it going so far for those first people? Yeah. Our residential retreat. That's it. Dharma talk done. This is it, right? It's the awareness of this. What comes from stopping and stillness is. We talk. There's different ways, and there's a lot of things. Different ways to say, but the real big key of practice is what happens when we stop and get still. Like, what do we notice? And what do we do with what we notice? And within the Buddhist context, we have a framework of ethic that we hold that guides us when we start noticing what happens when we stop. Because anybody can stop. And if you stop long enough, you will notice. That's what comes from stopping and stillness. But then when you notice, what do you do? What do you do with that noticing? And that's in the Buddhist context, we have an ethical framework that we use to guide what it is that we do when we notice who we really are. And that ethical framework uses mindfulness and different practices to help us, to help guide us when we notice who we are, that we don't judge ourselves, that we don't punish ourselves, but that we recognize that we're acting within a framework, and we're guided by these moral principles, these values, as to how to take care of that, of what we see. So that's where the secularization of mindfulness and meditation doesn't necessarily bring in a Buddhist framework or an ethical framework. It invites the stopping, it invites the stillness, it invites the looking. But what secularization doesn't do is it doesn't offer an ethical framework for what we do when we stop, what we do when we find stillness. And that's where the practice of mindfulness comes in. It brings in these ethics, these practices of non-killing, non-stealing, no sexual misconduct, no lying or slurring each other, no intoxicants. So we have that as our sort of our big ethical universe, so that when we practice stopping and stillness, when we see, we are acting from what we see within that space. We're guided. And we understand that our behaviors, the patterns that we carry out, the habit energies that we have, the speech that we have, the actions that we have, are cultivated from a socialization that we're all might say, privileged to, or at the bequest of, right? Because we're in this society. So I want to talk a little bit about social fabrication and individual fabrication. And I want to rest it on Alice Walker's poem and In the Color Purple, when Oprah Winfrey said, "All my life I've had to fight." So now there's a hip hop rap song that has that. I drop into it for y'all, but I don't think you can handle it. Okay, no, not right. But it's great. So there's a rapper who's taken that line, and just recently she was interviewed, Alice Walker, and she didn't know that. So they played it for her, and it was great, right? How her comment was that it was wonderful to see the intergenerational understanding what we have to do. So all my life I've had to fight. And in that line, I mean, there's so many things in that line, right? Now, in the movie, the line is talking about about rape, about women being abused. She says, after that, I've had to fight my uncle, I've had to fight all these places. So I don't want to stay just there. I want to move it to all my life I've had to fight. And depending on who we are and which group we land in, which social category we happen to land in, we all hold that energy in our body. We've all been fighting, right? It is a suffering world. This is a suffering realm. And it doesn't matter what skin color you have, what gender, what sexual identity, what sexual orientation, what immigrant status, what language, what class. There's a struggle. Everyone is going through a struggle, right? We all, in this life, we have to fight. So, why is that? Why do we have to fight? And what of this world's place that we're in, what of that has made us individually even fighting ourselves? Because if the socialized norm is that we have to fight and we have to struggle, it's in our body, it's in our mind, it's not just outside. And as activists, we tend to look outside for the fight. We tend to see that what needs to change is outside. Right? We look and we see injustice, and we are motivated to change that injustice, whatever the category of social injustice is, if it's racism, if it's classism, if it's immigrant, if it's homophobia, whatever it is. Often as activists, we're looking outside and we're advocating to change that thing. We're activating, we're organizing to change that thing. And sometimes it's easier to see the thing outside that needs to shift. You know, when you walk into a room and you immediately notice the frame on the wall, it's not quite straight, and we go over and we straighten it. It's easy to see the things outside. And as activists, we're kind of like that, right? We immediately hear a word that is exclusive of one group, maybe sometimes ourselves, and so we're going to remedy that. And that's a beautiful, glorious thing to have inside of us, the ability to recognize injustice and to step into change it. My challenge to us today is, are we able to understand that that way that the world has been socialized and fabricated, made that way, it's not just outside of us, that it's inside of us too. That we can't help but have been impacted in the way we ourselves are made up by a fragmented world. It didn't stop at this skin and the bone. It's infiltrated into our mind, right? So the baby that's born doesn't know it's a he or she. We tell that baby. Then we go on and we tell the baby how they're supposed to act because they're fit into a he or she category. And then we start treating the baby in a way that a he should be treated and a she should be treated. But when that baby was born, that baby didn't come out the womb with machismo, if it was a boy. Or it didn't come out the womb if it was a female biologically identified, thinking that it was inferior to a male. Certainly there's karma and the consciousness is there, yes. But the way that we interpret who we are as we grow up, it's completely socialized. It's fabricated. It's made up. And it's made up by a society that generationally keeps telling us who we are and how we are to be in this world. And we just accept it. And we wear the clothing that fits that who that person, who mommy and daddy or grandma or the pastor or the preacher or auntie have told us we are, and we put on the cute clothes and we're cute and in that role as that. And then we grow up and we take on the trappings and the robes. You know, we wrap ourselves in those robes of societal's characterization of who we are. And then we have children. And then we do the same thing to them. And it's not a good or a bad thing. There's beautiful things that come out of how we step into the world and how we take on an identity. And there's also hard things that come with that. There's suffering that comes with that. Because that categorization brings with it often oppression. Oppression based on who we are, which group we're in, whether that group has power or no power. Right? So if we're female identified and we go through life as that, we are continuously ascribed to this group of being inferior to men, just the way it is. Now, who said that was okay? Like, is there some universal thing that says that's right? But we do it. And the same with race, right? We have an anti-blackness dilemma. We have a dichotomy around skin color, white, no white. And even within the no white, there's a hierarchy as well, right? We judge according to the skin tone. And we just keep doing it. And we grow up, you know, when's the first time you learn consciously that there was a whole dichotomy around race? And then you learned it, and then you internalized it, and then you have kids, and then you take them to the store, and you see a black person, and if you're white, the little girl squeezes your hand. Where did that come from? You know, 2-year-old squeezes the hand of someone when you see a black person in the shopping market, because were they born like that? No, they weren't born that way. They learned it. They were socialized to feel like fear when they see someone darker than they are. So this idea, this all my life I've had to fight, it's not an idea, right? It's real. And if we look deeply, we can see where in that spectrum of the social fabrication of society we are in, and we can see how we act out as like little puppets that have told us who we are and how we carry out basically this continued dichotomy. I mean, this one, that one's there. And at any time we're walking in multiple steps, right? White female, black male, there's walking with the power of male and the lack of power as black. Same with white female, right? So we're carrying these multiple socialized identities, all taken up in this one form. And in any one moment, all those are intersecting, interacting on each other. And we treat each other according to those identities. And we all do it to each other until we stop doing it. Until we stop and notice it. So the Dhammapada, which is a book of teachings of the Buddha, states, all states of being are created by mind. It is mind that leads the way. So a lot of my meditation over the last years has been sitting with the understanding that everything that is here in this world has been created because people think it should be this way. And so then what it allows me to dream and vision and hope forward into is that if the mind has created this realm, then the mind can uncreate it. It can recreate something different, something more beautiful. Because everything is constructed from the mind, right? If the mind goes forward in a certain way, that's what comes from it. If it goes forward in a positive way, something comes from that mind. The mind goes forward in a negative way, that's what comes from that mind. So if the mind has constructed this world as it is now, then the mind can reconstruct. Right? I mean, this is the deepest teaching of Buddhism. Where the mind goes, everything else follows. And so we have to remove it from the philosophical, quote, you know, what we want to do, narrow spiritual vehicle that, and we have to expand it and understand what that means when minds have continuously created a world of separation and fragmentation. Because what that does, it's not to dwell on that, it's to dwell on the understanding that if the mind created that, then our collective minds can recreate something more beautiful, more equitable, and more sustainable. And the only way we can vision forward that kind of big change is to understand how it came to be, the root of it. And the root of it comes from the way we've been thinking. And so the root of change then must come from the way we think. And the way we think that change will only come when we are able to be still enough to notice how we participate. How has our mind participated in creating what is here now in this world? And it's not a blaming, it's not a judgment, it's a deep looking, it's an analysis, right? So that's the other deep teaching of Buddhism, is we investigate things. We gladden the mind, we find joy, we gladden the mind, and then we investigate the mind. And why do we gladden the mind? Because when we investigate, depending on what we find, we want to have the spaciousness to hold all of it, to take good care of it. So why do we sing? We sing to gladden the mind. We sing to get soft. We sing to open space. we sing to bring joy. So that when we stop and we look deeply and we see a lot of things that might be difficult, we're not overwhelmed. So when I say we have fabricated this society that we live in, you don't get overwhelmed and feel, oh, then there's nothing I can do. This has been going on generationally for thousands of years. What good little old me can do? Certainly, what good little old me can do sitting here with my eyes closed, meditating? But that's where it starts, because it's the mind that has caused this to be the way it is. And so if we can't get a hold of this thing that we only have control of, is this very mind and this body. So when we can have that control, when we can see clearly who we are, we then get to determine who we want to be. Do we want to continue to be who we are right now? In many ways, we're beautiful already, and we just keep stepping in that beauty. And also in many ways, we are fabricating the world that we say we're trying to fight externally. In the way we see each other, in the way we see ourselves. So the work of meditation and mindfulness and practice, it's not just to sit on this cushion and bliss out. Sorry. That's part of it. And part of it is to find joy and to find bliss. And then, in that spaciousness, in that place that we found bliss, in that deep looking where we can see more clearly, how are we guided to act differently and to co-create something that's more beautiful? That's activism. Doesn't get more radical than that, folks. Radical is the ability to be still enough to notice who we are and how we are contributing to the world. Going to a protest, stepping out and challenging something, that's radical. But more radical is the ability to know from whence we speak and from where we come. And that's why it's so hard to stop, because we're pulled by the masses. We're pulled by the external masses of movement. And that when we stop, especially in spaces of activism, we're often critiqued. Aren't you going to this, or there's this meeting? I know the world I'm in. There's always a meeting to go to. And yet, within those spaces, how do we find the balance to step outside and act with the body, and step inside and see, take care of what's inside, so that when we do step outside, we're coming from a place of clarity and spaciousness, right? Because if we're not healed, there is no way that we're going to participate in healing this world. And it is this unhealed self, this unhealed mind, that continues to fabricate that norm that's out here. That's that makes someone says, all my life I have to fight. Right? So this stopping, this walking mindfully, this noticing that when I'm stepping, I'm stepping. When I'm brushing my teeth, I'm brushing my teeth. When I'm closing the door, I'm closing the door. So I'm not with the hand on the door handle and my head's already up down the stairs and getting the next thing I'm gonna do. Like, can we really just be with that door? Can we finish what we started? Can we just close the door? We started opening and closing it. Can we finish it? Those simple little practices, they may seem mundane and silly, and who's got time for that? But those are the trainings that begin to shift the neural imprinting to create this moment of consciousness where, as in some other format, when we're about to say something that we're going to regret, we can actually see it. You see before you're about to utter something, and you stop, and you don't say that, or you say something different. That moment of being present with that door is a training that allows you, when you're in the midst of the chaos, to still see. It's the same kind of moment of consciousness awareness. So most of us would just say what we said, there'd be some craziness that happens from it, and then later that night, while we're eating what we said and we're regretting it, and we're beating ourselves up and we may even have indigestion, and we get ulcers and we don't even know why we have ulcers. But they're all connected, they're all interconnected, right? It's not all separate at all. So that moment of stopping, that moment of walking and being present in the moment when you can, like places like here, that's the training, that's the imprinting, that when we go out, we can see more clearly. There's a moment of spaciousness, and you don't even know where it came from. You just know that, wow, I just saw what I'm about to say. I don't want to say that. And then we stop. And that's activism. Because in that moment, we stop participating in the madness. We stop participating in the separation. We stop participating in reacting from anger, from hurt. We stop, we see what we're going through in that moment, and now we are, once we observe that thing, we're not absorbing that thing, and now we're responding from a place of awareness. We just woke up. In that moment, we woke up, and we became the owner of our thoughts and action. Before we weren't, we were just being led like a, you know, like a monkey by our thought and action, just emotional reaction to some hurt. It doesn't deny the hurt. The hurt is aware. What's different is the response to it. Have we shifted in our response? Or are we just reacting from a hurt that triggered something that was 10 years ago? Something might be generationally ancestral that's still in us. Is our reaction from that? Is our rage from that? Or is it from something that actually just happened? Well, in those moments of awareness, of consciousness, we see it. And it is in that seeing that we can decide how we're going to be different in the world. And it's that inner healing that results in us now bringing something different. We bring a different energy into the world. It really becomes that our teaching is our practice. It's not, I'm going to be peaceful. It's, I am peace. It's not, I'm going to be just. It's, my words are just. So our behavior becomes the teaching. We don't even have to open up our mouths. People respond to the way we are. And that comes because we've stopped and we've done this deep looking in ourselves. And we've seen where the pains are. We've seen what part of our body we hold stuff. So like when we do a guided meditation like this morning, where we're allowing the breath to help us notice, where is it stuck? Can we notice the breath energy moving through the whole body? Do we notice where it gets hooked up or lingers somewhere? We can do that, right? We have the ability to do that when we become still. I remember when I broke my leg several years ago, and I went to the acupuncturist, and she asked me to breathe, and I didn't know where the fracture was. And then I said, it's right here. And she said, well, how do you know? I said, because the breath didn't pass through here, it stopped right here. It's like it stopped and it went around. But I don't know that, right? Because I can't see in there. But when we follow our breath and we start this invitation to sense what the breath is doing in your body, to feel from inside your body, then we start to really notice. And so when there's something that's not lined up, when there's something stuck, when there's a pain that is so hard, could be a mother's pain that we're still holding, then we know and we start working with that energy, right? We start bringing breath. And maybe the breath can't move through it because it's so thick. So maybe we bring the breath to this side. And it moves in this side because this one doesn't have that tension. But as we nurse and take care of this side, because nothing is separated, this side starts to open up. That's the beauty and the nature and the wonder of the body being completely connected. So if we find a place that's hard and it's too hard to take care of directly, we take care of the opposite side. It's the same thing with the body, the arms, the legs. So that's why the invitation this morning was also to find a place where you can easily identify where the breath comes in the body. Where when you bring it in, you actually sense it. Most of us sense the body with the breath somewhere here. Others can sense it elsewhere, but a lot of us sense it here because we literally think of the breath coming in and out. So we start to sense, oh, I feel a pushing out in the belly here. Okay, so I sense it there. And so when we're in some difficult situation, it's going to be really easy to bring the breath to that area again. And immediately that becomes a calming. And so right there in the middle of everything, you found your breath, you brought it to a place of refuge, and now everything starts to calm down. Physiologically as well, right? Cortisol levels start to drop, the adrenaline drops a little bit. And now we have a head start. We're now in a place where we can actually be more aware and present. We can see what we're about to say and do. All of a sudden we see more clearly what the person in front of us is saying and doing. It's like we start noticing the subtle places that we miss because we're not calm. So this calmness is something that's not just bringing peace inside of us. It's allowing us to view all the subtle ways that things are happening outside of us. We notice the extra movement of the hand. We start noticing what the person might start moving or saying because we're still. And so it's like clear water, right? When the water is clear, you can see way down to the bottom. But when it's turbid and there's lots of waves and movement, the ability to see stops right at the surface. And it's the same thing with our mind. When the mind is clear and spacious, you can see so much more of what's there in front of us. In front of us and inside of us. But when there's a lot going on in the mind, and we're not in a place where we find calm or stillness, we see just what's right there. So this stopping, this calming, it allows us to be more present, it allows us to bring a different person into the world. That healed person now becomes a healer in the world, a true healer in the world, in all, every aspect, because now we're bringing this place of compassion and awareness and understanding into what is being said. So the reading this morning on the five ways to put an end to anger, so the fourth way, so the first time I read this, 5 ways of putting end to anger, I thought, they're crazy if they think like there's nothing nice about mind, nothing nice about body, nothing nice about heart, there's nothing left nice in that person, and you're still, if you're wise, you're still supposed to be kind to them, right? And I remember when I first read that many years ago, I thought, well, I've got a lot of work to do, because I didn't understand it even. Much less to read in the words, I thought, this is nuts. There's nothing makes sense about this. But nothing made sense to me because that's not the way we were brought up, right? That's the socialization piece, right? Someone hits you, you hit them back. Someone's mean to you, you don't deal with them, right? That discourse, the 5 ways of putting an end to anger, it goes completely against the socialized way. And the thing that kept me at it was, if the person is wise. So we all want to be wise, right? So I was like, well, I want to be wise. So I got to figure out how to do that. But the wise person responds differently. Okay? So it's the same thing. When we are aware, when we know and we see deeply, we become wiser. And so then we become to see why that person really is acting in that way. We're not stuck, we don't get stuck at the most superficial behavior the words that are mean, the bodily actions that are mean. It seems like they don't even have a heart. Sometimes, you know, when we say like, I don't think that person has a heart just because they're behaving so crudely. It's so painful, right? But after all that identification of that, do we still have the space to think, why are they acting that way? They must be suffering a lot. And that's what that teaching said, right? If this person is acting this way because they have so much suffering. Now, the ability to get to that understanding when someone is acting crazy like that in front of you, there's a gap there, right? How do we get there? Well, we get there by being still. We get there by finding ways to stop, to step, to eat, to talk. Because every moment that we are mindful, it's like we're adding another drop into this beam of transformation. So that when we eventually pile up those drops and we're in that interaction with that person that's acting crazily, we have enough drops that we can see beyond, and we have the spaciousness to go beyond that behavior and say, this person is acting really crazy. And so like that teaching this morning, it says, if that person is suffering so much, who's going to help them find a place to stay? They have no place to stay. They have no clothing. They have nothing. That ability to stop and notice is what allows us to get to that understanding. Who's going to help them? So that's hard work, right? Because that's like, and it's not repressing the anger you feel, okay? It's not that. We're not talking about repressing. We're not talking about taking on feelings of inferiority or living into our feelings of inferiority and think we deserve to be treated that way. It's not that. It's an awareness of all of what is in front of us and an ability to understand the roots of it and to make a conscious decision of how we want to respond to it. So there are going to be times that we don't have the energy to respond to it, and those are times you have to turn around and walk away and go have ice cream, right? Or tea, or go to yoga, or go take a nap, or go look at a cloud, right? But there's going to be other times where we have it in us to offer that person a kind word out of a space of compassion. Not because we feel inferior, but we have to accept that, but because we understand why they're being that way. Right. And that is our practice. That's transformative work. That's engaging in a world of suffering. And so if we think that all my life I have to fight, well, I've kind of transformed. I've said all my life there is a fight. I get to choose when I'm going to fight. I get to choose because I'm going to notice when there's something that's just too much for me and when there's something that I can deal with. And if I don't have the fortitude in me right now to come from a place of compassion, I need to step away. If the only way I can respond right now is to hate is with hate, I need to know that. I need to be able to know that this hurts so bad, I'm about to like, you know, my hands are clenched outside and inside and my heart's clenched. I need to step away. So I'm a person who never used to, one, notice that my heart was clenching, and two, would not step away, but I would, the clenched fist would become something external, right? If not in my hand, in my words, right? So I know the spectrum. You know, and it's not a shame, you know? It's not a shame to say, hey, as my mom says, you can give as good as you get. That's right. Never seen someone so angry, and she's telling me all these things. Like, you're right. Don't mess with me. And then what? Right? And then what? Do we just stay there? Well, no. Been there, done that. I want to do something different. Right? We all want to do something different. Right? that kind of rage and anger and responding like that, it gets us so far. It gets us maybe here. We're talking about a kind of transformation that gets us where we don't even know yet, because we don't even have the ability yet to vision the kind of world where we don't have to fight. Right? And so will I live in a world where that happens? Probably not. I'll probably die before then. But some of you are half my age, and maybe you will. But if we keep doing the same thing, then your children, the ones half my age, your children are also going to be in the same, all my life there is a fight world. So we are the vanguards. We are the ones. We decide what it is we're going to do differently. So we come here this weekend. We took the time, you know, like I have all kinds of gratitude for you, because you took the time. You were wise enough. This is the wisdom. The wise person would do this. Right? We don't think about wisdom sometimes. But Buddhism is a wisdom practice. It's all about wisdom and love. That's what deep understanding is being wise. And the understanding comes from a heart of love. So, we have about 15 minutes, and first I had thought we could break up into like two or threes and share with each other something for you that you, where you felt this overwhelm, all my life I've had to fight. Because for everybody it's different, right? Just because we come and so we see different struggles in our life. So we can do that. We can break into groups of twos and we can share that. And it's not a sharing to like demoralize. It's a sharing to acknowledge that there's this that we live and we know, and then there's this other way that we're moving toward. And the acknowledging that this is the world we're in and this is the one we're moving toward is so critical. That way we move with eyes wide open. We know where we're going. We're stepping towards something that's more beautiful. So we can break into twos and do that, or we can just round robin share within the circle. So I'm looking at you and I think we're gonna break into twos. I was just kind of looking at the energy in the room. But if you want to stay in a group, in a big group? Yeah? Okay, let's stay.
Can you take questions?
I think y'all, yeah. Experiencing, touching yourselves in this way might be good. Because then it sinks in. Like if you have to identify these things in yourselves, it takes a different way of looking at it. The question would be, I think, a little bit, maybe later. Okay, so someone wants to share. Yeah.
When I look at that statement, all my life I've had to fight. I think we've been socialized to think that fighting has to be like an external force, right? For me, as I step into this maturity, this new level of maturity, as a healer, I think the fight looks different for me now. My fight is in the midst of
you still have time to break into two. Not a threat, it's a sharing.
So every day there's a pull to like read rights, I think about my family and how I was raised. Being a young person, remembering my mom saying, you know who you are, Heather, you're a black female, you know, nothing is ever gonna be, nothing you do is ever gonna be great or good, even if you do something twice as hard as that white person, it's just never, you'll just always be. Not as good. So I think that I think about that. I've been thinking about that a lot in the past year, and I think a lot of that comes from my mom teaching me how to survive with who she felt like she was raising me to be, and never feeling, or never knowing, or not having the tools to teach me how to thrive. So seeing survival as suffering, and sometimes being equated with this fight. So I've always kind of thought of, this injustice that I face personally, I should expect it because of who I am, right? My mom said, this is always gonna happen, I'm just gonna always suffer, just gonna have to survive. So I think for me, this fight comes very natural, and I struggle in this practice with fighting against that because I feel like I need to continue to survive, and surviving for me equates to fighting, and fighting equates to suffering, which equates to injustice, which I can fight against, but it's always it's a circular thing in my head. So this practice has helped me figure out that it's okay to thrive, and in order to thrive, you have to heal. And healing in my life has been a lot harder than suffering in the fight, because the suffering in the fight comes very natural, and the healing and thriving doesn't.
Thank you all for the deep sharing, and y'all are listening. So it'd be wonderful to continue, but I want to be mindful of time, and I think this says it's 10:30. Is that right? Yep. So I'm thinking, we could have maybe one more sharing, and then we'll sing a song, and then we have a short break until walking meditation at 11. And we'll continue this this evening in Dharma sharing.
Space, I think my fight has always been finding space to live authentically as a whole person. So I'm a daughter of immigrants. For my parents, especially my mother, moving here was a traumatic experience. I think growing up, I felt I needed to be perfect, justify this trauma that they experienced. I mean, and adjusting. So I think my fight has always been just over the years figuring out a space to be an authentic and flawed individual and not a person who's jumping through hoops to either live up to their hopes and expectations and dreams for me, and also the expectation also of American society, where I always felt pressure to just like jump through hoops to prove that I belonged here and I was worthy of being. Many, many spaces in which I'm so deeply trained to just be just very, very deeply trained to be living up to those external expectations. I'm trying to untrain.
Thank you all for your deep listening, your deep sharing, and for this energy. There's a really nice energy here in the space, and I feel your full presence. It's wonderful. So we have this song, and I think some of us, at least half of us in this room, know the song. I wrote the words up there. So maybe we can sing it together a couple times. Yeah. And it goes on to the second page, which is, the second page is actually the most important part. And so we have to find it.
Gonna let life stir me deep.
by the three sounds of the bell to close. You have some rest time, and then we'll meet. Let's meet downstairs in the dining area for walking meditation. Bring the necessary gear. It's not raining, but it's probably, you know, yeah, that's it. But remember, rain and sun, okay? Okay. So thank you for your listening and your energy.
We didn't mention it before, but about 5 minutes before each activity, you'll hear the sound of the bell as a signal to kind of transition to the next thing. So about 5 minutes before the walking practice, you'll hear the bell. That's your cue to, we'll get ready. So at the next sound of the bell, let's stand, take a moment to massage your legs, stretch. We'll stand and bow to each other, and then the last sound of the bell, we'll stand and we'll bow to the ancestors.